Welcome back. This is Judge Sleater along with Judges Ross and Reyes. And we have, it looks like Nicholas Rotar. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Rotar,
thank you.
But that's fine.
This is the third of our three oral arguments this morning. And as in our previous one, we have counsel only for appellant, Mr. Rotar. In this case, the respondent has not briefed or in notified the court in any way, as I understand it, to take part in this proceeding. And so, Mr. Rotar, you'll notice that we have Jason Heikkinen, who is the marshal for today. So when we start, he will show the clock by his phone, so you'll be able to see the 15 minutes that you have. Of course, there'll be no rebuttal since there's no response. And so otherwise, everything will be the same. If at any time you have some difficulty or notice some with regard to the technology, either we'll know it before you do, or you can let us know if you're noticing it, and we'll suspend the time so we can get it resurrected. But otherwise, proceed according to normal. We will have you identify yourself for the record when we begin, because we are recording these proceedings. Any questions, Mr. Rotar?
No, Your Honor.
Very well, then. I'll note for the record, the file number is A200078, American Family Insurance versus Corey Klinghetz, respondent. And as I say, we'll hear only from appellant's counsel today. And so, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm attorney Nicholas Rotar on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, American Family Insurance. The issue presented today on appeal is whether the district court wrongly held that the appellant does not have uninsured motorist bodily injury subrogation or not. There's a cause of action in this matter.
I'm only catching part of what Mr. Rotar is saying.
I'm noticing that as well.
Matter.
Mr. Rotar, can you hear us? Mr. Rotar?
Sorry about that.
We're apparently hearing you only intermittently. Should we have him call in separately?
Sorry, what was?
Okay. We've suspended the time, Mr. Rotar.
Can you hear me, or is it just the video, or is it?
Well, we can hear you very sparingly, and you're suspended in animation a couple of times.
Okay. Okay, so I stopped my video. Did that help with the connection?
So far, I believe so. I've been able to hear that explanation to my colleagues here, Mr. Rotar.
Yes, I think that's better.
Very well. Why don't we continue that way? We did get a chance to see who you are, and otherwise we'll hopefully hear now from you. And I'll try to,
okay.
You can still see the clock, I presume, though.
I can.
Very good. You may continue.
Okay. And I guess, what was the last thing that the court heard? I guess if I could start there.
I think it is correct in the pronunciation of your name.
Yeah, that's right.
I think what we'll do is have the marshal restart at 15, if you would, Jason. We'll just have you start over.
Okay. Okay. So good morning. May it please the court. I'm attorney Nicholas Rotar on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, American Family Insurance. The issue presented on appeal today is whether the district court erroneously held that the appellant does not have a viable uninsured motorist bodily injury subrogation claim against by virtue of the Minnesota No Fault Automobile Insurance Act. The determination of whether or not there's a viable subrogation cause of action for uninsured motor bodily injury is a question of law that is reviewed de novo. As a brief recitation of the factual background, I will state facts that were either stated as undisputed by the district court and or further explanations as laid out in the unanswered requests for admissions that are therefore deemed admitted under the law pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 3601, as the defendant respondent did not answer our request for admissions, which laid forth identity, liability, and damages.
Mr. Rotar?
More specifically on... Yes.
Mr. Rotar, I have a question along those lines. And you, in your statement of facts on page 3, you mentioned that, and I want to turn your attention to paragraph 3. At the very end of that, you say that AMB was made whole by the appellants, and it's an id, and it looks like you're referring to doc ID number 13 and 14. And you, as you mentioned, you also referenced the undisputed facts and the request for admission that were unanswered and admit as a matter of law. What support is there in the record for that statement that AMD was, quote, made whole by the appellant?
Thank you, Your Honor. So as attached to the notice of motion for summary judgment that we brought, we attached the request for admissions under Rule 36 as Exhibit A, and therefore in there stated that she was paid out the $160,000 uninsured motorist bodily injury, and it also led to Exhibit D therein, which shows the amounts that were paid out for AMB, who was a minor at the time of the accident. The damages total were $210,606.75. $50,606.75 were personal injury protection, which we were not able to subrogate in Minnesota. And so we only brought the uninsured motorist bodily injury amount of $160,000. And based upon the record that I had before me, there was no claim by our insured that she was not made whole by the damages that were paid out and that are documented in Exhibit D.
Okay, and I saw that with respect to the RFP on page 2 and 3. I'm sorry, the RFA, the request for admissions. Items number 13, 14, and 15 specifically go to that and mention Exhibit D, but I don't see any statement in here of AMB being made whole. This just references the amounts that were paid to her of $160,000, but I don't see any indication that that was it. And it seems like the case law, including the cases that you cite, stand for the proposition that you have to show that the insured has indeed been fully compensated to fulfill, make sure that there isn't any double recovery occurring at all. So how do Exhibits D and the RFA 13, 14, 15 show definitively that she was made whole and that there aren't any other outstanding monies that one party or the other or both might seek to pursue and recover?
Sure. And I guess to that point, the request for admissions, I mean, specifically do not have the admit that AMB was made whole. That's something that I will obviously need to concede. What I would point back to is the Exhibit D shows payments over the course of, I believe it was 3 years, maybe four, because the accident was in 2012 and the last payment was in 2016. I don't have anything in the file showing that AMB was claiming that there were any damages beyond what was paid out ending in 2000. And that's when we initiated this action, because my client, the insurer, had presumed that there were no longer going to be any claims against it I believe there was a release signed by her related to that. I have that in the record, though, so I don't know if I can speak on that. My client and the insurer brought the action because it believed that it had paid out any claims that were going to be made by AMB ending in September of 2016.
Well, that's all fine and well that your client assumed that there weren't going to be any amounts, but how is the district court supposed to know, and how are we supposed to know that there aren't any potential claims that might be outstanding and that this is over and done with? Because typically what we see in the case law is there's some type of agreement between the insurer and the insured stating all claims have been satisfied, or you know, something to that effect. I don't see that anywhere here in the record.
And that's correct, Your Honor. I don't have that in the record before the district court or before the Court of Appeals today, because it was not before the district court.
So how can we, it was the district court wrong then in its decision? Because if that information wasn't before it, and it certainly didn't make any findings on that issue, why is the district court's decision an error then?
Well, the district court's decision in error, I suppose, would be that the analysis that the court applied for dismissal with prejudice is incorrect. We moved for summary judgment based on the lack of an answer, the lack of responses to the request for admissions, and the evidence that we had in the file. If the district court determined that the reason was not granting summary judgment was because it was lacking a release or a statement directly from the insured stating I've been made whole, there are no other extraneous damages, that would have been something that we would have supplemented the factual record with if that was the analysis the district court was applying. The district court was applying a different legal analysis. The district court was saying you don't have a right to bring an uninsured motorist bodily injury claim at all, and because it's blocked by the No Fault Act. And then distinction that we were trying to make in our appellate brief and also in the memorandum that we supplemented to the district court was the No Fault Act does not eliminate the common law principle you are allowed to bring subrogation for uninsured motorist bodily injury coverage that's been paid, as the court is noting astutely, if the insured has been made whole. If the court's analysis in dismissing the or denying the summary judgment motion was relied on that, or dismissing the case with prejudice was based upon that, that would be one thing. I think procedurally, though, if the district court found that there was evidence lacking in the motion for summary judgment, we still would have been entitled to proceed with the pretrial submissions and a trial on this matter, which would have permitted us to then have the insured as a witness testifying that I've been made whole, I don't have any other damages, I have a release, etc. By doing what the district court did, it prevented us from supplementing the record or presenting that.
Mr. Rotar, is it not true, however, the court in its conclusions did accurately refer to the Flannery decision, which its holding permits subrogation by a reparation obligor upon payment of uninsured motor vehicle or motor insurance benefits to the extent that its insured will achieve a duplicate recovery? So would not it be necessary as part of finding, or it would be behoove your client as part of its claim and the evidence presented at the time of the summary judgment to demonstrate that there is an attempt to seek double recovery, which would necessarily require an answer to Judge Reyes's question, which she's been fully compensated and she now seeks more than fully compensated.
Well, so in response to the Milbrandt, how I see this, or how I interpret what our cause of action is and why is the State Farm Mutual Insurance Company versus Galloway, 373 Northwest 2nd 301 304, where they state, if the only tortfeasor is an uninsured motorist coverage is easy to apply. Rather than try to collect from the uninsured driver, the claimant will ordinarily seek to collect from her own carrier. The carrier, having paid the benefits, is then subrogated to the claimant's action against the uninsured motorist and attempts to obtain full or partial reimbursement. And that's the exact case that we have here. We paid out uninsured motorists. There's coverage benefits. There's only that one tortfeasor who does not have any insurance coverage. And under the Galway explanation, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in 1985, they're stating exactly what we're trying to do in subrogating that claim amount that we've paid out. I'm sorry, I don't know if I answered your question or not. Was there something more specific that you wanted me to address there?
My question, though, is, and I don't see, but you can tell me how Galloway reduces the or is inconsistent with Flannery, which does require a showing that there's a seeking of double recovery. And the court made specific findings, which I assume is not in dispute. I'm looking at finding number 8 in the looks like the September order. To be sure, this is not a case where plaintiff is attempting to stop double recovery from its insured. Does that not directly respond to the Flannery and not necessarily inconsistent with Galloway?
Yeah, I don't think Galloway is undermining or inconsistent with Flannery. I just think Galloway explains that the cause of action that we're bringing is a permissible cause of action. That you can bring an uninsured motorist benefit claim. That specific explanation from Galloway didn't get into the requirement for a double recovery. I would say in Flannery, though, the explanation for their holding or how they're getting to it, the rationale, they're stating that the only where's the pin site would be at 644. The only way to avoid double recovery in uninsured motorist insurance cases is to infer a legislative intent to allow subrogation upon the payment of uninsured motorist insurance benefits. And so I take that to mean that in the insured motorist context, that a double recovery what I took that to mean is that this uninsured motorist benefits coverage existed prior to the act. And if you paid them out, you were able subrogate them against a tortfeasor, and the act did not address uninsured motorist, and there was further in Flannery explanation that it was not intended to change the law on uninsured motorist insurance protection or subrogation, as was argued or discussed in that case, that bringing an uninsured motorist or allowing subrogation in that context would be preventing a double recovery. And that's I guess how I read Flannery, is that it still permits the subrogation of uninsured motorist insurance without requiring first a payment of double damages or double recovery. Those specific iterations of you need double recovery before you can get paid out are in Minnesota statute 65B53 subdivision 3, but that's related to no fault benefits. We're not talking about no fault benefits here. We're talking about uninsured motorist coverage benefits that are outside the scope of the No Fault Act. The explanation of those double benefits that are relied upon in Milbent and Flannery, we're talking about No Fault Act economic benefits. And in this case, we're not talking about that. We're talking about uninsured motorist benefits outside the scope of that. And I see my is running out, so I would ask the court to reverse and remand, at least to allow for the further recitation as pointed out by the court in terms of a needing of a finding that the insured was made whole, was improper to dismiss with, because there is still a viable claim under Minnesota law. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Otar. And that did help. The audio was much better when you turn your video off. If you want to turn your video on, since you went to the trouble, we can see you one more time before we say goodbye. You're welcome to do so. We thank you for your briefing and your statements that you made here today. And we will take the matter under advisement.